So yesterday we were talking about metaphor as a sense organ, as a way of getting at and understanding aspects of our life that the other six organs can't get at. Things about our life that are actually there, but we can't see them, we can't hear them, we can't taste them, we can't touch them, we can't smell them, we can't think them, but they're actually there, and possibly the most important parts of our life. And so maybe metaphor as a way of evoking those parts of our life. And I actually think that that's not a metaphor. It's really true. I think it's actually true. I think this is one of the really main things about being human, is that we have this tremendous life that we need to understand that we can't understand through the six senses. And I want to be, it's an important point here that I want to make, that this life is not just my life. In other words, it's a life in which what I am and what you are is engaged with the whole world. It's engaged with others. You know, there's no such thing as, you know, some me in the sky, right? I'm only living and existing because I'm embedded in a world. So that story, that life, that hidden life, that metaphor will help me to get some purchase on, is not an atomized, isolated life. It can't be. So that's one thing we were talking about yesterday. Do you remember? Yeah, we were talking about that. And then we were talking about stories and how many stories we experience every single day, how immersed we are in stories, and how we're immersed in our own stories, our personal stories, the stories of our friends, and how maybe we need to take a step back and realize that although it may be that there's no getting away from stories and we're not trying to get away from stories, maybe if we understood our stories differently and held them differently and saw them as part of this vast sea of stories, that would make a difference in the way that we in our whole way of approaching our actual lives on a daily basis, how the choices we would make. Someone raised the question, how do we know what choices to make? And maybe if we held our stories in that different way, it would influence the way we made our choices and the way we conceived of our lives. So that's a little review of what we were talking about yesterday. And then I asked you when you went home and before bed to think about this in your own life, your own stories and how you hold them, and how you could hold them differently, perhaps. So I want to read a little bit more from the book. And of course, the proposition is, what can we learn about from the metaphor of the journey home, that is the metaphor of the Odyssey, and what can we learn from the story of Odysseus, and how does his story maybe inform our own and help us to look at our own stories and learn something about our own lives. So, and that's how I came to write this book, actually, is that I began using stories from the Odyssey in Dharma talks, not with any thinking it through and realizing what a great idea this would be, but it just happened to be that I was reading the Odyssey at the time, and I just used it in talks, and then people said, oh, that really helps, or that's useful, and I did it some more, and I kept, as the more I did it, and the more intentional I got about it, the more interesting it became to me and the people that I was practicing with. And one of the things that was useful about it is typically when you do religious practice, of course you are working with stories. You know, if you're a Christian, you're working with the story of Jesus and his life. If you're a Buddhist, you're working with the story of the Buddha and his life and so on. And the trouble with those stories is that they're the stories of more or less perfect human beings. You know? And then, sort of without knowing it, you know, the proposition then becomes of all these great religions, let's emulate the perfect human being. Let's be like that. And then you're trying. And of course, there's something great about that. You know, there's something great about trying to follow in the footsteps of some incredibly noble and ideal and idealized human being. Why shouldn't we aim, you know, for that in our lives? And that's I think that's why religions are so compelling, because we all understand, yes, a human being could be like that. And why don't we try to be like that? And so there's something really beautiful about that. On the other hand, there's something problematic about that, because then we keep noticing that we're not like that, you know. And then we keep it sort of reinforces our sense of, gosh, you know, I just don't measure up. The more I try to be like Jesus, the more I see, you know, what a schlemiel I really am. You know? It gets worse and worse. The more I try to be like Buddha, you know, the more I see that I just persistently am not like that. So the longer on I go, the more frustrated I get. Well, in a sense, you know, we don't really have this problem with Odysseus, because Odysseus is a lot like us, very imperfect. You know, in a way, when you read the Odyssey as a child, it sort of seems like Odysseus is this great, you know, warrior hero and so on and so forth. But if you actually read the Odyssey as a mature person a little more closely, he is not. He has many problems. And a lot of the disasters that happen in the Odyssey are his own fault, you know. He falls asleep at the wheel, like literally, several times. and bad things happen. So that's what happened when I was talking about Odysseus. People in the communities that I was speaking to said, yeah, we can really relate to that, you know, because that's more like us. You know, we do fall asleep at the wheel, and we have all these, you know, flaws. And so it really helps us in our practice to be contemplating the story of someone who is not a perfect paragon of virtue and mindfulness. So here's the opening lines of the Odyssey that sort of set the tone for what Odysseus' character is like. Sing to me of the muse. Sing to me of the man, muse. So this is Homer evoking the muse, because the story of the Odyssey is told by the muse to Homer, who then writes it. Sing to me of the man, muse, the man of twists and turns, driven time and again off course. Once he had plundered the hallowed heights of Troy. Many, many, many cities of men he saw and learned their minds. Many pains he suffered, heart sick on the open sea, fighting to save his life and bring his comrades home. Those are actually the opening words of the poem. So Odysseus is not a simple man. These lines tell us he's been banged around quite a bit by time and fate. He's endured a lot. He has been defeated many times by forces beyond his control. In his travels, many of which he did not choose, they were thrust on him, often exactly against his will. He has encountered and observed many sorts of people, and he has learned to make use of their ways to further his own ends when he could. He has few illusions because he's known a lot of hardship, a lot of despair, a lot of suffering. He's a shifty, leathery fellow, more of a character actor than a leading man, a survivor. He can be really tough when he's cornered, and he's just as willing as the next person to plunder and pillage as he did at Troy and as he does afterward in his voyages. But at the same time, he's deeply loyal to his wife, Penelope, and to his native land, Ithaca, and his whole life has to do with, from Troy on, has to do with his constant desire to return home. He's a great talker. He's a great storyteller, whose tales are mostly false, but always persuasive. He's also a master of disguise, who can appear as a beggar or a mighty warrior depending on the circumstances. From time to time, he succumbs to his passions, or even to his world weariness. He falls into despair sometimes. He wants to give up sometimes. And often, at crucial moments, he does exactly the wrong thing, compounding his own problems. So the Greek phrase here that is translated, I forget which, I used in this book all the different translations of, not all, but four or five different translations of the Odyssey. And here the phrase that's rendered as man of twists and turns is really a literal way of translating a word that we could also say is means wiliness or trickiness. Tricky Odysseus, wily Odysseus. Because this is his main characteristic. That's what the first thing that's said about him. He's a wily, clever guy, full of tricks and deceptions. And this is important because in ancient Greek culture, this sort of trickiness, this sort of quick-witted, strategic trickiness is very much prized. Thanks to this quality, more than to, physical strength or even courage, innovative entrepreneurial people were able to craft and shape reality, win victories, advance society. So this quality of craftiness, trickiness, cleverness maybe is a word we could use, cleverness, is really prized in Greek culture, and that's why Odysseus is such a great culture hero. Athena, who's the goddess of wisdom, but really the goddess of cleverness, she invented in Greek culture, most of the domestic arts. She also is the inventor of music. And in the Odyssey, she is Odysseus's main ally. And she's sort of his goddess, his protector. And she's also described with the same terminology, clever, cunning. So this is a really prized trait. But there's a knowledge that, important as this trait is, it also is problematic. For trickiness and cunning are just as likely to bring us trouble as to get us out of it. And this double-edged characteristic of Odysseus really figures into the story. You might say it's his working out of this, the implications of this characteristic is what the Odyssey is all about. And the thing is that we're like this too. When you think about it, we have had to be like this to survive in this tricky world. We have to be wily and cunning. We have to get over our innocence that we had when we were children. I mean, you could say that's what growing up is, right? It's getting worldly. To be worldly means to be cunning and tricky and to be able to survive in a complicated world. Because if we're too innocent, too naive, too pure, too nice, too good, we won't get along. So we've internalized this, and we also have become pleasing people. People who can shift and change shape as conditions warrant. And this is normal and natural. We've had to do this. But it has a downside. For the worldliness we develop to ensure that we can survive in this world eventually becomes embedded in the identities that we craft for ourselves to get through this dangerous world. And we begin to think that that's who we really are. We begin to believe our own deceptions. And we slowly drift away from our perhaps truer, more vulnerable, and also probably less presentable inner selves. And you know, in adolescence, I mean, that's one of the painful things about adolescence, don't you think? Why adolescence is such a stormy time? Because we're sort of having to really let go of our innocence and sort of, it's a violence that we do to ourselves to survive in this world as adults in some way. I mean, it's necessary. It's not something we can avoid. And yet it's not a pleasant thing. And as time goes on, it may become untenable. Until perhaps, like Odysseus, one day we find ourselves, and this is a quotation from the poem, heartsick on the open sea. So, Odysseus, it's a long story, but he doesn't really want to go to Troy to fight, and he tries to get out of it. Odysseus is the first draft dodger. He actually does what a lot of young men did in the 60s. You know, he, in effect, tries to take a bunch of LSD and pretend he's crazy to get out of the war. But it doesn't work, and he has to go. So he goes reluctantly. And they're there at Troy for 10 years. And you know the famous story of how they finally, that nothing works for 10 years. You know, it's a little bit, again, a little bit like Vietnam. Nothing works. You know, it doesn't work out. Except in the case of Troy, they finally win because of the Trojan horse. Remember? This very deceptive, tricky thing, which is, by the way, Odysseus' idea. That's who thought of the Trojan horse. Anyway, the war's over. And now he's coming home to Ithaca, where his wife Penelope and his son Telemachus are waiting for him. But 10 years is a long time to be away, and in his absence, things have gone downhill. The people, the young men of Ithaca figure, after 10 years, Odysseus must be dead, so they are all gathered around inside his house, all asking Penelope for her hand in marriage. And they're waiting for her to choose someone. In the meantime, they're spending all their time drinking Odysseus' wine, killing Odysseus' cattle, eating Odysseus' household stores, and basically threatening, literally, to destroy the substance of Odysseus' home and steal his wife. That's what's been going on while he was gone. Now, the suitors represent life's blind and relentless tendency toward disorder and entropy. When you're not at home, it's not like things just sort of sit there and wait for you to come back. Things go downhill. Things fall apart. When we don't pay attention to our lives, and as we were talking, Joe and Kurt and I, to our planet. It's not like it just sort of waits there for you. When you don't pay attention, things fall apart. It devolves into chaos and confusion and destruction. Somebody inevitably moves in and starts slaughtering your cattle, drinking your wine. And we, in our going forth into the world to make our way, can be dissipating our spiritual treasures. The treasures that we were born with as children and that we possessed in our youth without even knowing it. Without maintenance, a house falls down. Without weeding, the fields go wild. And without tending, our inner lives will slowly but surely become disordered, so that when we need them most, when the circumstances of our mature lives require them, our moral fiber, our wisdom, our compassion, and our love may not anywhere any longer be there for us. And this is the problem. The prequel to the Odyssey, of course, is the Iliad. And that's a poem of going forth. That's a poem of honor and glory and conquest. And in this poem, Odysseus and his companions, led by Agamemnon and Achilles, set out for Troy to avenge the abduction of Helen, defeat the Trojans, and prove their valor. The Odyssey, by contrast, is a poem of return. The war's over. The struggle now is not to conquer and advance, but simply to return home. And earlier in the book, you know, I say maybe this is the state of humanity. Maybe like we've been through the conquest part and the domination part, and now maybe we all have to return home to our being here as human animals on an earth that we can live in harmony with. Maybe that's what's going on in our civilization. We're kind of crossing over from that, going out and making our mark to coming home, and we don't know how to do that yet. Anyway, I think that's also true for us as individuals. We have done the work of going forth into the world to seek fortune and fame, find out who we are in the world so that we can build what we have to build in a lifetime. That does happen in every life. That's something we have to do. We have to go forth. We have to go out. But now, more experienced and having lived for a while, having encountered the twists and turns of pain and suffering, now it's time to come home. Now, coming home sounds comforting and restful, but the Odyssey is all about how it's actually not so easy to come home. Because in our absence, these forces of destruction have gathered, and when we arrive at home, we're going to have to do battle with them in order to take our rightful place. And Odysseus's return takes 24 books of the Odyssey to be accomplished. And the journey of return that maybe we all have to make in our lives also takes a long time. So that's a little sketch of, you know, Odysseus that we can maybe identify with him as a character, as a story, and his plight, which is maybe like our own in many ways. Now there's another, he's of course the main character of the Odyssey, but it occurs to me that there's another hero of the Odyssey. The sea itself. In world literature, the seascapes of the Odyssey are very famous. And every time something happens in the course of the plot, when you think about it, what happens always is Odysseus sets out to sea, and he goes from one island to the next, and the action happens on the island. But between every incident, there has to be this going forth again out to sea. And so much of the poem is these descriptions of what happens at sea. The wine-dark sea, which swells with mountainous tumult, heaves with steep valleys, blows up fearsome gales, glows in the sunrise, glistens at midday, shimmers in the moonlight. It is the province of powerful gods who control its flow and use its power to achieve their own willful ends. And whenever something happens, it's preceded by a time at sea. Every time you go out to sea, you don't never know what's going to happen. The sea is dangerous. You may, you know, get where you're wanting to go, or you may not. A storm might come up and blow you somewhere entirely unexpected, which often happens to Odysseus. About the sea, the French philosopher and mystic Simon Weil says this: "It is not less beautiful in our eyes because we know that sometimes ships are wrecked by it." On the contrary, this adds to its beauty. If it altered the movement of its waves to spare a boat, it would be a creature gifted with discernment and choice, and not this fluid, perfectly obedient to every external pressure. It is this perfect obedience that constitutes the sea's beauty. It's an interesting, profound thought. Our lives are taking place in this kind of sea that doesn't operate according to our needs and wishes. And that's its beauty. And that's also the source of a lot of our pain, is, you know, why don't things go the way we want them? Why doesn't life work out the way we had planned? Why are we subject to these, to the whims of this powerful sea that holds us? And the Odyssey actually opens with Odysseus sitting on Calypso's island, looking out to sea, weeping. That's the opening of the actual scene of the Odyssey. Because he's trapped on Calypso's island, he wants to go home across the sea, and he can't leave. And I was thinking, you know, this is something that human beings like to do. We all why do we like to do this? Why do we like to sit and look out to sea? Isn't that something that everybody prizes an ocean view? Like, why? You know, there's nothing to see there. Like, what are you looking at? But somehow there's something great about you know, looking out to sea. There's something actually very profound about it. In a way, you might say, like, maybe this is the first and most profound of all meditation practices, right? Just looking out to the horizon. Why do we like that? I live on the ocean, so I'm always looking out to sea. And you never get tired of it, somehow. You never get tired of it. Because it's like looking at the sea of your own life. The currents, the depths, the constant motion. Sometimes beautiful and peaceful, sometimes full of white caps or crashing waves. And always perfectly obedient to forces that I will never understand. So the sea is also a character in our lives too, don't you think, in just this way. So what I'd like to do now is ask us to reflect on these things together. I hope that in reading these things and speaking to you, I've been able to get you in the mood of feeling your life in somewhat of a different way than the way you usually feel it. Maybe there's some gaps or holes in the story, some places where light and air can come in. Maybe there's more room for the unknown, the undescribable.